It's good to see everyone today. In just a moment, we'll begin in the 11th chapter, about verse 12, I think. In our last class, we looked at chapter 10 and saw that Tola, a man of Issachar who lived in Ephraim, judged Israel for 23 years. And after he passed, Sher the Gileadite judged Israel 22 years. And because he had a large family and they oversaw a lot of cities, he seemed to be prosperous with multiple wives. The polygamous marriages and nepotism seemed to hint toward degeneration in the people. When we reached verse 6, we read, "Then the sons of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord, served the Baals and Ashtaroth and the gods of Aram, the gods of Sidon, the gods of Moab, the gods of the sons of Ammon, and the gods of the Philistines. Thus they forsook the Lord and did not serve him." And as we looked at those sad words of verse 6, we read passages from chapter 2, chapter 3, chapter 4, chapter 6, where God used the very same words, and then saw that they'll be used again in chapter 13. Verses 7 and 8 said, "The anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and he sold them into the hands of the Philistines and into the hands of the sons of Ammon. They afflicted and crushed the sons of Israel that year for 18 years. They afflicted all the sons of Israel who were beyond the Jordan and Gilead in the land of the Amorites." So when Israel finally cried out to the Lord there in chapter 10, verse 10, for help, admitting their sin, forsaking God and serving the Baals, God reminded them how he had saved them in the past. In verse 14, he suggests that they ask the false gods they've been worshiping for help. And finally, in verse 16, Israel put away the false gods and served the Lord. As we looked at chapter 11, we said that, well, Larry did the wrong thing. As we began chapter 11, we said that the closure of chapter 10 really feeds right into chapter 11, because as you look at what is occurring at the end of chapter 10, Ammon was preparing to move north against Gilead, and the men of Gilead were looking for somebody to lead them and become the leader. And Judges 10, 17 and 18 says, "Then the sons of Ammon were summoned. They camped in Gilead. The sons of Israel gathered together and camped in Mizpah. The people, the leaders of Gilead, said to one another, 'Who is the man who will begin to fight against the sons of Ammon? He shall become head over all the inhabitants of Gilead.'" I hit the wrong slide, apparently. There we go. From verse 1, we see that Jephthah was from Gilead. He was a valiant warrior. He was illegitimate by birth. From Hebrews, the 11th chapter, we see that he is spoken of respectfully by the Lord in the chapter of faith. He attributes Israel's victories to the Lord and not to himself. He calls upon the Lord to judge between Israel and Ammon, and Jephthah received assistance from the Lord and made a rash vow. We said that was the overview of what we're going to be studying. As we came to verses 4 through 8, we see the elders of the people are fearing the Ammonite warriors. They want a leader. They ask Jephthah to be the leader. He reminds them that they sent him out of his homeland and says, why should he help them after they treated him so harshly? And the elders admit their need for help, offer him the leadership position over all of Gilead if he'll fight Ammon as their leader. Then as we got to verse 9, Jephthah makes the elders repeat their offer to take him back And secondly, God has to give him the victory. Verses 10 and 11 show that he challenged them, but they pledged to make him their leader. So that brings us to about verse 12. I know someone had a comment about the verses we've covered. Do you want to make that now or later? Okay. In verse 12 we read, "Now Jephthah sent messengers to the king of the sons of Ammon, saying, 'What is between you and me that you have come to me to fight against my land?' The king of the sons of Ammon said to the messengers of Jephthah, 'Because Israel took away my land when they came up from Egypt, from the Arnon as far as the Jabbok and the Jordan, therefore return them peacefully to now.'" Peacefully now. Huh, that's kind of interesting. In verses 12 to 28, Jephthah is going to try to negotiate with the king of Ammon by first asking, "What's the problem? You know, I don't understand. Give me some understanding." And what the king is going to say is, "Israel took our land when they came out of Egypt." That's not quite what happened, is it? Beginning in verse 14, "But Jephthah sent messengers again to the king of the sons of Ammon. And they said to him, 'Thus says Jephthah, Israel did not take away the land of Moab, nor the land of the sons of Ammon. For when they came up from Egypt and Israel went through the wilderness to the Red Sea and came to Kadesh, then Israel sent messengers to the king of Edom, saying, "Please let us pass through your land." But the king of Edom would not listen. And they also sent to the king of Moab, but he would not consent. So Israel remained at Kadesh." As we look at that, Jephthah is going to make some points with this Ammonite king that Ammonite king's not going to like. But first, Jephthah appeals to history and responds saying, "Look, fella, we asked both Edom and Moab if we could cross their land. When Edom and Moab refused permission to cross their land, we didn't cross it. We remained in Kadesh," Numbers 20. Then in verse 18, "Then they went through the wilderness and around the land of Edom and the land of Moab, and came to the east side of the land of Moab, and they camped beyond the Arnon. But they did not enter the territory of Moab, for the Arnon was the border of Moab. And Israel sent messengers to Sihon, king of the Amorites, and the king of Heshbon. And Israel said to him, 'Please let us pass through your land to our place.' But Sihon did not trust Israel to pass through his territory. So Sihon gathered all his people and camped in Jahaz and fought with Israel. The Lord, the God of Israel, gave Sihon and all of his people into the hand of Israel, and they defeated them. So Israel possessed all the land of the Amorites, the inhabitants of the country. So they possessed all the territory of the Amorites from the Arnon as far as the Jabbok and from the wilderness as far as the Jordan." As you think about what's going on, you know, Jephthah is saying, "Historically, we haven't caused you a problem. Here's the truth." And in verse 18, he says, "We went around the land of Edom." Now, and these words I use, historical argument is what he's just said. Now he's going to use one involving God, a theological argument, if you will. He says in verses 18 to 22, "Israel detoured around your land, and when Israel crossed the land of Ammon, King Sihon didn't trust Israel and came out and started to fight. And as a result, God defeated Sihon, and God of Israel gave the right to the land and to the people of Israel, and that's how they came to possess the land of the Amorites. It's God that gave them the land." Pretty strong argument. Verse 22, "So they possessed all the land from the Arnon as far as the Jabbok, and from the wilderness as far as Jordan. God delivered it. Comments through this verse. I know we had already gotten down into some of these verses on Wednesday night. Verse 23. Since now the Lord, the God of Israel, drove out the Amorites from before his people, Israel, are you then to possess it? Do you not possess what Chemosh, your God, gives you to possess? So whatever the Lord our God has driven out before us, we will possess it. Now, are you any better than Balak, the son of Zippor, king of Moab? Did he ever strive with Israel? Did he ever fight against them? While Israel lived in Heshbon and its villages, and in Aroer and its villages, and in all the cities that are on the banks of the Arnon, 300 years, why did you not recover them within that time? Verse 27, I therefore have not sinned against you, but you are doing me wrong by making war against me. May the Lord, the judge, judge today between the sons of Israel and the sons of Ammon. King of Ammon was real happy, wasn't he? No. Look at verse 28. But the king of the sons of Ammon disregarded the message which Jephthah sent him. Not a very wise man. So as you look at verse 23, Jephthah has given a historical argument. And now he's giving an argument that deals with God. He finishes the theological argument. He says the true God of heaven is who gave Israel the land. So what right does the king of Ammon have to it? Further, the only thing the king of Ammon should claim is what that false god Chemosh has given him. So what has that king given you, King Ammon? That's your land. In other words, you have no right to this land. If you think you do, answer is simple. Take it up with your god Chemosh. That's pretty straightforward. In essence, God gave them the deed to the land. Then he says, basically a political argument. He says, now are you any better than Balak, the son of Zippor, king of Moab? Did he ever strive with Israel, or did he ever fight against them? That he's given an argument from history, saying we weren't a problem long ago. He's given them an argument involving the true God of heaven and their false God by saying, you can have whatever your false God gives you. We've been given this land by the true God of heaven. And now here's basically a political argument. He asked the Ammonite king if he thinks he's better than the Moab's king. It just happens that the Moab king has not tried to fight Israel over land. So if the king of Moab hasn't given us a fight, why are you causing problems? And then we have the next argument. I therefore have not sinned against you, but you are doing me wrong by making war against me. May the Lord, the judge, judge today between the sons of Israel and the sons of Ammon. That fourth argument, well, let me back up. Verse 26, while Israel lived in Heshbon and its villages, and in Aroer and its villages, and all the cities that are on the banks of the Arnon, 300 years. Why did you not recover them within that time? Now, that's basically an argument of precedent, an argument of chronology, if you will. You've had 300 years to recover this land. In my lifetime, 300 years is pretty good time. 300 years ago, that brings us to the 1700s when this country was being settled, doesn't it? I mean, that's a pretty good while ago. But in 300 years, they haven't tried to take the land back, and they haven't done it. So Jephthah has a conclusion here. Jephthah concludes that Israel has not sinned. Therefore, I have not sinned against you. But you are doing me wrong by making war against me. Do you think the Ammonite king was impressed with these arguments? Doug, if he were preaching, would say, nod your head no. Verse 28, but the king of the sons of Ammon disregarded the message with which Jephthah sent him. He wouldn't listen to the arguments. What do you think through these first verses at the end of chapter 10 and here in chapter 11? Facts. It's going to go downhill from here for the Ammonite people. Somebody.
The same scenario has been playing out between the Palestinians and Israel for the last 50 or more years. That's all they took it away from. They lost it. God gave it to Israel. They've been making the same claim.
These people seem to have long memories. When was Israel declared a nation state? 1948, roughly? And the battle continues. Absolutely. Now we come to a section of the verses that make you wonder about Jephthah a little bit more clearly. Verse 29. Now the Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah so that he passed through Gilead and Manasseh. Then he passed through Mizpah of Gilead. And from Mizpah of Gilead he went on to the sons of Ammon. Jephthah made a vow to the Lord and said, if you will indeed give the sons of Ammon into my hand, then it shall be that whatever comes out of the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the sons of Ammon, it shall be the Lord's, and I will offer it up as a burnt offering. So Jephthah crossed over to the sons of Ammon to fight against them, and the Lord gave them into his hand. He struck them with a very great slaughter from Aroer to the entrance of Minnith, 20 cities, and as far as Abel Karaman, So the sons of Ammon were subdued before the sons of Israel. I want to go on and read a little bit further. Let's stop here. As we read these verses, events are going to move swiftly. In verse 29, we see the Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah as he gathers his troops to go through Gilead and Manasseh. He then went to Mizpah to prepare for battle against Ammon. And then in the next set of verses, we come to the vow of Jephthah. He asked God to give him victory over the Ammonites. And to acknowledge the victory, he would dedicate to God a burnt offering of, in the red print, whatever comes out of the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the sons of Ammon, it shall be the Lord's. And I will offer it up as a burnt offering. As you look at that, one definition of a vow is a pledge or oath of a religious character and a transaction between man and God in which man dedicates himself or his service or something valuable to God. Did you ever make such a vow? As I look through this room, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. You know, there's probably a dozen people or families at least represented in here where a vow like that was made. What? Do you remember it? That was long ago for Linda and I. But when we married, we make a vow before God often, don't we? One of the main points as we study these verses that we should take away is that a vow is a very serious matter. It cannot be taken lightly. A vow before God cannot be taken lightly. As you look at verses 32 and 33, so Jephthah crossed over to the sons of Ammon to fight against them, and the Lord gave them into his hand. He struck them with a very great slaughter from Aroer to the entrance of Minnith, 20 cities, and as far as Abel Kerman. So the sons of Ammon were subdued before the sons of Israel. Successful fight. The Ammonites didn't win. The good guys won. The Lord is the one that gave the victory to the men of Israel. And it was a pretty big victory. You know, as you see here, it's going to cover quite a bit of area involving 20 cities. I guess the Ammonite king wishes he had never started this tussle. What would you like to say through verse 33? I saw somebody rub their nose and I thought they were going to raise a point. Dale?
Today, or anybody, not human sacrifice, but
Absolutely. Grant and I were talking before class in the book of Judges. We're going to, and in the Old Testament, we see several men who are listed in Hebrews 11 who had episodes in their lives that were not acceptable before God. Let's read verse 34 through 40. When Jephthah came to his house at Mizpah, and behold, his daughter was coming out to meet him with tambourines and with dancing. Now she was his one and only child. Besides her, he had no son or daughter. When he saw her, he tore his clothes and said, "Alas, my daughter, you have brought me very low, and you are among those who trouble me. For I have given my word to the Lord, and I cannot take it back." So she said to him, "My father, you have given your word to the Lord. Do to me as you have said, since the Lord has avenged you of your enemies, the sons of Ammon." She said to her father, "Let this thing be done for me. Let me alone 2 months, that I may go to the mountains and weep because of my virginity and my companions, I and my companions." Then he said, "Go." So he sent her away for 2 months, and she left with her companions and wept on the mountains because of her virginity. At the end of 2 months, she returned to her father, who did to her according to the vow which he had made, and she had no relations with a man. Thus it became a custom in Israel that the daughters of Israel went yearly to commemorate the daughter of Jephthah the Gileadite 4 days in the year. As we look at verses 34 and 35, a parent of an only child returns home, and the first thing he sees coming out the door is his only child. His only child's a daughter, and she's celebrating her daddy's return, safe return home from war. Her daddy's heartbroken, crushed, overwhelmed with grief, because he knows he made a vow to the Lord that he needs to keep. Now you see why I call it a tragic vow. Remember, a vow is a pledge or oath of a religious character and a transaction between man and God in which man dedicates himself or his service or something valuable to God. Jephthah's daughter is worthy of respect because she says in verse 36, "You have given your word to the Lord. Do to me as you have said, since the Lord has avenged you of your enemies, the sons of Ammon." She said to her father, "Let this thing be done for me." She then makes a request that her father honors. She asks for 2 months to mourn the fact that she'll not be married, she'll not have children or family. And her father says in verse 38, "Go." Now, many of you have a child or children. You know in your heart how you would feel if you'd made this vow and this was the result. I don't doubt that we each would willingly give our lives for our children. As verse 38 continues, his daughter and the companions go to the mountains for 2 months, mourn her virginity. She's not going to have a family. And then, as we go forward, she returns, her father fulfills his vow, and lives the remainder of his days with the knowledge of what has occurred. As I said earlier, one of the main points we should take from this is that a vow to God is a very serious matter. As we look at this, verse 40 says that her honorable behavior was remembered each year by the daughters of Israel, who spent 4 days commemorating her memory each year. What would you like to say through verse 40? Anybody? Okay. Let's read the first verses. Well, we'll read the first six verses of Judges 12. Then the men of Ephraim were summoned, and they crossed to Shaphan and said to Jephthah, "Why did you cross over to fight against the sons of Ammon without calling us to go with you? We will burn your house down on you." Jephthah said to them, "I and my people were at great strife with the sons of Ammon. When I called you, you did not deliver me from their hand. When I saw that you would not deliver me, I took my life in my hands and crossed over against the sons of Ammon, and the Lord gave them into my hand. Why then have you come up to me this day to fight against me?" Then Jephthah gathered all the men of Gilead and fought Ephraim. And the men of Gilead defeated Ephraim, because they said, "You are fugitives of Ephraim, O Gileadites, in the midst of Ephraim and in the midst of Manasseh." The Gileadites captured the fords of Jordan opposite Ephraim, and it happened when any of the fugitives of Ephraim said, "Let me cross over," the men of Gilead would say to him, "Are you an Ephraimite?" If he said no, then they would say to him, "Say now Shibboleth," but he said Shibboleth, for he could not pronounce it correctly. Then they seized him and slew him at the fords of the Jordan. Thus there fell at that time 42,000 of Ephraim. You'll remember that Ephraim is kind of in the middle of the country, west of the Jordan River. This slide shows you a little bit more clearly where the Gilead, men of Gilead lived and where Ephraim was located. And once again, we see that the men of Ephraim are unhappy. Have we seen that before? Yes, back with Gideon. They were angry, and we see that they're unhappy, and they rebuke Jephthah for having gone to battle and without them. And back in chapter 8 was where we saw Gideon deal with these people as well. And then they're so unhappy, they threaten to burn his house. These people from Ephraim are a piece of cake, aren't they? And Jephthah says, "You didn't arrive in time. You don't have a right for a complaint." And as you look at this, he says, not only did you not arrive in time, you don't have a right to complain, but we fought these people at great risk to our own life. And finally, the bottom line is, the victory wasn't because of Jephthah and the men of Gilead. He says there, "The Lord gave them into my hand." It was God who defeated the Ammonites and gave the victory. Ephraim doesn't have any basis to be mad. But as you look at the activity here, because then Jephthah gathered all his men and Gilead fought Ephraim, and the men of Gilead defeated Ephraim, because apparently they had said something that was improper, made an condemned. And there's some name calling going on here in verse 4. Name calling. An ethnic slur, the condemnation. I don't know that I fully understand the depth of why this caused anger, but Jephthah and Gilead and the men of Gilead fought Ephraim because of what they said there. "You are fugitives of Ephraim, O Gileadites, in the midst of Ephraim and in the midst of Manasseh." And maybe he says, "Look, you're really occupying some ground that you don't even belong in." So the result is that a fight occurs, and the men of Gilead are very smart. They capture the fords of Jordan. And by capturing the fords of Jordan, the men of Ephraim that are on the east side of the river trying to get back over to the west side where Ephraim is located have to cross. And the men of Gilead have a really neat test. They say, "Pronounce the word Shibboleth," because for some reason the men of Ephraim can't say it. They say Shibboleth, and 42,000 men are killed. As a result, Ephraim paid a, a large price for their difficulty. And then Jephthah judged Israel 6 years and then was buried in one of the cities of Gilead. And some of the commentators make an interesting point here. You know, we know that we sometimes are told where people are buried, but Jephthah didn't get a lot of respect. You know, he had very humble upbringing. And instead of saying which city of Gilead, it's just he was buried in one of the cities of Gilead. Any comments through verse 7? Verse 8, now Isban of Bethlehem judged Israel after him. He had 30 sons, 30 daughters, whom he gave in marriage outside the family. And he brought in 30 daughters from outside for his sons. And he judged Israel 7 years. Then Isban died and was buried in Bethlehem. And as I was reading this morning, James E. Smith's mentions that there are two Bethlehems and suggests that perhaps Isban of Bethlehem was from Zebulun, in the area of Zebulun in the north, and not down from Judea. That's just a thought. I don't know that I can confirm it one way or the other. We're now meeting three judges as we go through here. Isban of Bethlehem had a large number of children, 30 sons, 30 daughters, brings in wives for those daughters, which may indicate that he was wealthy, he was powerful, had multiple wives, married his children to people of the land and not Israelites. And that violated Deuteronomy 7, verses 1 through 4. So this is about all we know about him. In verse 11, now Elon the Zebulunite judged Israel after him, and he judged 10 years. Then Elon the Zebulunite died and was buried at Ajalon in the land of Zebulun. We know he lived 10 years and where he was buried, and that's about the name of that. And then as the chapter ends, now Abdon, the son of Hillel, the Pirathonite, judged Israel after him. He had 40 sons and 30 grandsons who rode on 70 donkeys, and he judged Israel 8 years. Then Abdon, the son of Hillel, the Pirathonite, died and was buried at Pirathon in the land of Ephraim, in the hill country of the Amalekites. And Pirathon looks like it's in the general vicinity of Mount Gerizim, in the northern part of the area of Ephraim. We see a family of large wealth, a large spread out family, probably multiple marriages to have 40 sons. That's about all the Bible tells us over these three judges. What would you like to say over the 10, 11, and 12 chapters? Well, our time is up. Grant will begin the study again on Wednesday evening.